The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest series of adventures on Planet Porky, in life on Planet Porky, this podcast with myself, the Porkmeister, and of course, the Rockchick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, I have to say, very early this morning, I was out and about and I went across the heath to my newsagent supplier to pick up my papers, which I do every morning. Well, I don't every morning. Sometimes I have them sent over, but this morning I thought I'm going to go over there. So it was early. It was about 5:45. You have to be very careful these days that you're not hanging around in the paper shop for an hour until the papers arrive. When I was a newspaper boy from the age of about 12, I could get to the paper shop at 5:30 in the morning. The papers were there. I'd put my round together, 25 Laurel Grove is the Telegraph, and then 13 Lime Grove is a Mail. And you had to mark up your round and then put them in your bag and slip your bag over your shoulder, get on your trusty bike and shoot off and deliver the papers. And you could all be done by 6:30. But these days, sometimes the papers don't even arrive until, well, sort of 7:15, 7:00, and I find that very frustrating.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. My mother's papers are delivered between 4:30, 4:00 every morning.
Really?
Which I think, far too early. Some guy brings them round in a car because all the local news agents stopped delivering and they just shut down the service. So they get flown into Biggin Hill Airport in one of those little private jets. Yeah. And then some guy picks them all up in his car and goes around dropping them all off.
Good God. And how much does that cost her for delivery?
I don't know.
Well, that's...
No, not an awful lot, because my mum is frugal and she wouldn't pay over the odds for it,
Well, I think there's a difference there. They must be first editions, which obviously are all done and dusted and usually, out by 1:00 in the morning. I think because I live in the Stockbroker Belt, we get the last editions and they don't even arrive until sort of 7:15, 7:00. Anyway, I was lucky this morning. I was out at precisely 6 a.m., got over to the shop by about 20 past, and they just arrived as I arrived. The white van arrived and picked them all up and came back. But the reason I'm telling you this is because, without a shadow of a doubt, today was the first great day of the year for me. It was the first autumnal day I've come across. The frost was on the ground. Windscreens were frozen. There was a bite in the air. I halfway there, I thought, I've been a mug. I should have got my scarf on this morning. I love wearing scarves. It makes you feel sort of safe, doesn't it, and warm and all that kind of stuff. And then as I was trudging across the heath, the grass was actually crunching beneath my feet, with a bit of frost. So.
Oh, there's something thrilling about that,
yes,
isn't there?
Yes.
I do like this time of year. It's if you take a country walk and there are berries on the branches,
yes,
and frosted leaves, and it's just a very nice wrap up warm time of year. It's lovely.
I totally agree, and you're right. The brown leaves all over the place. You've got to be careful with those brown leaves. If they get wet, they can be lethal underfoot. You have to be
very slippery.
Very careful indeed. And I always am. That's why I wear trainers a lot these days. It helps you to grip the pavement rather than leather shoes, which they can be lethal, leather shoes. If you've got lovely leather soles, whoosh, it's like skating on ice,
Oh, my granddad used to take a penknife to the soles of all our leather shoes.
Good idea.
When we had school shoes and all that. Yeah. And he used to score them across.
Good idea.
Sort of in a crisscross to make them have a bit of tread.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I totally agree. A great idea.
By the way, I must tell you that today would have been my father's 91st birthday.
Good God, amazing. The legendary Ken Jones, soccer writer, sports writer, friend of Muhammad Ali. 91 today, eh? Well, that's in.
I can't quite believe it. It's 91, yeah.
I'll tell you why that's so interesting, because I noticed, just, you know, flicking all the things I do during the week, that Bobby Charlton is 85 today. So your dad and Bobby Charlton have the same birthday.
I never knew that. They were great friends as well.
Yeah.
They've been friends since the 60s, since the famous World Cup win. Well, perhaps since Munich, actually.
Yeah.
Although my dad wasn't on that plane.
No. Well, thank God he wasn't on that plane. But
thank God he wasn't on that plane. But I never knew that they shared a birthday. Yeah. That's so interesting.
Bobby Charlton is 85 today. And now he's Sir Bobby Charlton, okay? And has been for quite a long time. And I've tried to start this campaign over the years to get Bobby Charlton upgraded to a Lord, Lord Charlton. Because if you think about it, there are cricketers who've become lords, like, you know, Lord Botham and Lord Cowdrey. There are runners who've become lords, like Seb Coe, who is Lord Coe. There are people in other sports who have become lords. Some of them have become dames and baronesses and that sort of stuff. But football's never had a lord. And I think that's a disgrace. When you think that, you know, Stanley Matthews was the original superstar footballer, Bobby Moore, the World Cup captain, Bobby Charlton, probably the most famous English footballer of all time. Why haven't any of them been made lords? I just don't get it.
Well, I think it has to do with the charity work that they do or don't do, because they have to do something to be prominent to earn their lordship, if you like. Mm-hmm. They don't just get it for being who they are.
If you think about
he did masses for the Olympics, didn't he?
Well, that's not a charity. I mean, that's work in his field, and Bobby Charlton's done work in his field promoting football.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
I don't know in that case. You know, obviously, I've never sat on one of those committees, so I don't know what the criteria may be. But it is interesting. They should have. Maybe there's a prejudice against football that they don't want to discuss.
I think you're right. You know, they could say, oh, well, a cricketer, decent chap, member of the MCC, goes to Lords all the time. We can put him in the House of Lords, you know. Same with Seb Coe, who was a bit of an intellectual as well. But I think they think that footballers are, you know, not really worthy of the title of my lord or your lord, which I think...
That needs to change, doesn't it?
Of course it needs to change. But anyway, there we are. Now, talking about football again, this is a common link. A guy who I worked with a lot, he didn't work on my paper, but I used to see him around a lot at all sorts of events, was a photographer called Eamon McCabe. And sadly, Eamon's passed on at the age of 74. But my God, he was a legendary photographer. And he was so good that even though he was a sports photographer, ostensibly, he used to take pictures sometimes, which won him the News Photographer of the Year award, even though he was a sports photographer. And one in particular was a picture at the Heysel Stadium. He was there to cover the European Cup final. It was Liverpool and, let me get this right, I think Juventus, that's right. Yeah, Liverpool-Juventus, because I went to it the following day. So he's there to cover Liverpool-Juventus at the Heysel Stadium in Belgium. The stadium was a disgrace. I mean, it wasn't fit for a five-a-side game, let alone a European Cup final. And one of the walls collapsed. And the wall that collapsed meant that Liverpool fans spilt over onto the Juventus fans who were in the pen next door. And sadly, 30 Juventus fans lost their lives. But Eamon took this incredible picture from his position sort of around the goals somewhere, you know what I mean, with a long lens, pointed it up, saw what was happening, and then won an award for the News Picture of the Year because he so captured the tragedy at the moment that nobody else was aware of. And, you know, really terrific guy, a master of his craft.
Had an eye, didn't he? I read a lovely quote in one of the obituaries. Yeah. Which said, words may give newspapers their voice, but pictures provide their soul. Mm. And that's what he was very good at, wasn't it? It was capturing the soul of a situation or a person. It's there is some relationship between people, a person, and a lens that isn't always captured by the eye alone.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. You know, people often say, crikey, you know, when I used to go abroad on a story, you'd go with a snapper, a photographer, and sometimes we'd be away 5 or 6 days. And at the end of it, there was one picture and all my words, which had taken, well, as you full well know, it take 4 or 5 days to accumulate. Nobody says, wow, what an easy life that photographer's got. It's not quite true, because if he doesn't come back with a picture, he's finished. You know what I mean? And whilst we can get our words either by word of mouth or on the telephone or, you know, some observation, whereas a snapper's got to be there at that moment, bang, to take it. You know what I mean?
And quite often there's only one opportunity to the relevant snap.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I totally agree.
So there is an art to it, and there's also cunning and all the other skills that journalists and photographers require. Yeah. You know, they have to have the whole package.
Oh, definitely.
They?
Yeah, I totally agree. No, what happened with Hazel was I was sitting at home and, you know, I love football, obviously, and even though it was Liverpool playing in the European Cup final, well, it is the European Cup final. I'm an Evertonian, but you've got to watch it, you know. So, and in those days, you didn't have 2 hours of build-up because there were no pure sports channels. It was probably on the BBC, and they would just give you like a 15-minute build-up kickoff. You see what I mean? So I switched on. The kickoff was probably 7:30, so I must have switched on about 7:15. And Jimmy Hill was ashen-faced and reporting from the studio that, you know, there'd been some crowd disturbance or some sort of event in the ground, and people were now lying at the side of the pitch on the running track. And I thought, hang on, what's going on here? But you could tell there was utter chaos. So I rang the news desk, the Daily Express news desk. I was working for the Daily Express. And a guy called David Alliades was the night news editor. I got on very well with David, but David knew nothing about football, right? So I said, David, I said, have you got the European Cup final on in the office? He said, no, this is the news desk, Mike, not the sports desk. I said, no. I said, switch the television on. And we didn't have many televisions in the newsroom in those days.
We had one at the Daily Mail.
I think we had one because there was no rolling news channel. So, well, you know, why would you want one? So David switched it on and he said, good God, what's happening? I said, well, something terrible has happened. And, you know, I'm trying to find out. I'm ringing around, but I'm told that some of those people lying on the running track next to the pitch are in fact dead. And he said, my God, he said, go, literally told me to get there. So I literally went downstairs, got in my car, you know, packed a little bag of basic thing, got in my car, drove to, where would I have driven to? Folkestone or Dover, one of the two, went across the channel and drove to Belgium, to Brussels. It was Brussels, wasn't it? Yeah, not Bruges. Yeah, Brussels. And I got there at 6 a.m. the following morning. And, of course, I did what we would always do on a live story. Don't even bother getting a hotel. Park up outside a hotel and get off to the stadium and get off to the fire station and get off to, you know, the hospital and all that. And I did all that. Didn't finish till about 5 o'clock, and then filed volumes and volumes and volumes of stuff, you know. A tragic story.
A really tragic story, but what a true trooper you were.
Well,
you know, that's a proper journalist, isn't it? Just dropping everything and going.
Well, yeah, but I'd like to think that everybody had the same instincts as me. And you know, I thought to myself later, wow, I got away with that. I was lucky enough to ring in. I must have been the first to ring, because if somebody else had rung in, they'd have been sent. You know, in fact, funnily enough, four other people were sent during the course of the night. And it was my first experience of actually running something, of like being a boss. Because when we all knew which hotel we were going to, because we all had to call back to the office once we got to the continent, you know what I mean? And they'd already found a hotel we'd all rendezvous at. So drove straight to this hotel. We were all in reception. And I said, look, it's no good throwing paint at the wall here. We've got to divide up the responsibilities. I said, I'm going to the stadium. You go to the hospital. you go to the police station and you go to the airport and find some fans who are leaving. And nobody argued with me because I'd taken control. I said, and we'll get back here, do you understand, at 5 o'clock and we'll divvy it up and we'll file four separate stories, okay? Right, okay. And, you know, one of them said, why are you making the decisions? I said, because I was told to. David Elijah told me last night to sort it out. So let's not argue, let's get on with it, you know. So off we went. But there is a caveat to it. One of the guys, and we've spoken about him before, I think, his name is Colin Bell, and he was a reporter with me. Cole was having a coffee at the table bar, so to speak, in reception. And I'm not sure where I'd asked him to go, but wherever it was, we got back at 5 o'clock and he was still there drinking brandy. He'd put brandy in his coffee at breakfast and he never left that stool. It was, you know, it was a classically sort of devastating Fleet Street story of somebody who got it so completely wrong. And in fact, and God rest his soul, but this is only the plain truth, it was the first time we realised that Carl, in fact, had a terrible drink problem, you know. And of course, we did what you always do in that situation. We put him to bed and we covered for him and, you know, got all the details of the story he should have covered and filed for him. But those sort of things happened during our lifetime, didn't they?
Oh, yeah, quite a lot, yes. Mm.
Anyway, so obviously Liverpool were involved in that terrible tragedy, the truth of the matter was the wall was unsafe and the wall collapsed because of the pressure of fans leaning against it and fell into the Juventus side of the ground and 30 of them died. A year later, I was sent to Turin, where Juventus are based, to do the one-year anniversary. And my God, the abuse I got all over town. You know, why have you come? And, you know, you come to taunt us and all this kind of stuff. And I said, no. I said, I know what happened. I said, I went there the next morning. I said, I saw the wall that had fallen down, you know, on your fans. I said, it was a disgrace. I said, but, you know, nobody murdered anybody. You know, it was a tragic, terrible accident. But anyway, there we are. Enough of that.
The trouble is about tragic accidents. Yeah. As we always say, people feel the need to blame somebody. Somebody has to be responsible for what happened. Yeah. And this blame culture that we live in is responsible for so much that is wrong with society today.
Well, you could well be right. The philosophy of wisdom, I would say, Miss Jones. Now, Miss Jones, you and I were chatting about a very funny story which we should share with our listeners. I think it's funny. Shay Given, the goalkeeper, and his girlfriend, and Shay, who I've worked with a few times, by the way, he's Irish international goalkeeper, played for Newcastle, I think, when I used to watch him. His marriage broke up, new girlfriend, gives the new girlfriend an Aston Martin and a £300,000 ring, which, I tell you what, he's doing well there. Footballers didn't earn that much in Shay's day, so he did very well. Anyway, that unfortunately breaks up, and now Shay would like to have his Aston Martin and his ring back, but his new girlfriend is rather reluctant to return those gifts. Where do you think she stands on that? Do you admire this lady for taking a stand? Okay.
It used to be that if the man dumped the woman, she kept the ring and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So if you're engaged to somebody and then the guy decides he doesn't want to marry you, he doesn't have the right to ask for the ring back. Mm-hmm. If you leave him, you're obliged to give the ring back. That was always the understanding.
Right.
But the tradition of engagements. I don't know whether they were engaged, but why would he give her a ring otherwise, I suppose. Mm-hmm. The Aston Martin, well, if it was a gift and if it was presented as a gift, you know, we don't give each other Christmas presents and then ask for them back, do we? If we fall out with a friend or something.
No, absolutely.
So it's only on a larger scale of that.
Yeah.
You give something, you've given it. It belongs to the person you gave it to. Mm.
Yeah, no, I accept that. You can't suddenly say, oh, look, I only gave it you because we were friends. Now we're not friends. I'm going to un-give it you. I totally agree. You can't do that, can you?
Absolutely not. It's the same as, I don't know, I take you out for lunch,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And then we have a massive argument. We've fallen out. I'm not going to ask for the lunch back.
No, that's right, yeah. And I don't say, or you don't say, right, you owe me for that lunch now, do you? Because it's a situation which emerges from the circumstances at the time, isn't it?
Exactly. So I think, sorry, Shay, but you haven't got a leg to stand
on.
Yeah,
no, absolutely. Now, what do you think about the Eurovision Song Contest being awarded to Liverpool? I mean, that's a couple of days back, but... I'm very shocked to hear that Liverpool hoteliers are now upping their prices on the night of the Eurovision Song Contest and the night before by a factor of times 10 because they know the city is going to be rammed. So I was listening to one person who had booked their hotel provisionally, went to then confirm it when Liverpool got the award, to find that the hotel room had gone up from something like £180 a night to £1,900 a night. I mean, it's a bit harsh, isn't it?
It's utterly disgusting. I'm really ashamed of Liverpool for doing this.
Well, I think it would happen in any city. It would happen in any city, yeah.
Well, I suppose so, but let's not forget that Liverpool hasn't been awarded the Eurovision Song Contest. Yeah. It is only hosting it on behalf of Ukraine,
right,
who are not in a position to host it themselves at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm disgusted to hear that people's wedding bookings from 2-3 years ago,
yes,
have been cancelled,
yes,
because these hotels are chasing Eurovision attendees.
Yeah, they are.
The hotels in Liverpool have always been rubbish anyway.
Oh, I totally agree.
I'm thinking of the Adelphi, for example.
Oh, don't talk
about that. I was there in 2020 doing research for my book about John Lennon,
yeah,
and I just could not believe how shabby it was.
Oh, I agree. It's called the Britannia, isn't it?
That's a different hotel,
no,
isn't it?
No. I think it's, and I hope we're not besmirching the Britannia. I think it's part of the Britannia Group because every year there's a like a voting system on hotels, and you know Britannia don't always do that well, you know, in the ratings, and people are always writing in. But you're absolutely right about the Adelphi. I stayed there a few years ago because we were doing a live show in Liverpool, and it just so happened the O2 Arena where we were doing it was the nearest hotel was the Adelphi. Now, the Adelphi was a very famous hotel between the wars. My dad used to talk about it in hushed tones, you know what I mean? Oh, we're going for lunch at the Adelphi and all that kind of stuff, you know? And it was a top posh hotel because it was the only hotel in Liverpool. Anyway.
It was like the Ritz. It was the equivalent of the Ritz in the north, wasn't it?
It was, honest to God. You know, the Adelphi Hotel, Liverpool, just at the end of Lime Street there, a couple hundred yards from Lime Street station. And it was a landmark in the northwest of England. You're absolutely right. But when we went and stayed there a few years ago because of the O2 gig we were doing, I could not believe it. It was like a one-star hotel. And apologies to the Adelphi if it's more than one star, but that's what it seemed like to me that night. But there are some good, very good hotels in Liverpool now. The other one we used to stay at, there was only one other hotel. It was called the Atlantic Tower, and it was called that because it's a big, tall hotel overlooking the Mersey and wonderful views out into the, you know, the sort of the Atlantic and that kind of the Irish Sea, actually, and that kind of stuff. But you're right. Wherever I go now, I stay at the Crown Plaza on the Albert Dock. It's a beautiful hotel, and again, it overlooks the, you know, the waterways. It's very close to the Beatles Museum, and it's just a short walk up into town. But there are other very good hotels in Liverpool now. But when you say, you know, you're ashamed of Liverpool, you've got to remember these hotels are all owned mostly by international chains. So the manager of the hotel in Liverpool won't have had any choice. He'll have had an instruction from London or New York or Japan or somewhere to cash in on the Eurovision Song Contest.
Yeah, I guess so, but it's still disgusting. I mean, but hotels have gone mad since we opened up again after the pandemic.
Yeah, I agree.
So here's an example. I have two daughters, both of whom went to Exeter University 10 years apart.
Right.
And I would always stay at the Premier Inn because it's cheap and cheerful,
yeah,
it's nice and clean,
absolutely,
comfortable beds, why pay more? Mm. If I booked... say 6 weeks in advance, which I often would. I'd go down, then I'd book the next visit as soon as I left this visit,
yeah,
so that I always had a hotel room booked when I needed to be down next.
Mm-hmm.
I would be paying £29 a night,
yes,
which is standard charge you would think for a hotel, yes, like the Premier Inn,
right? I agree.
When I went down for Bridie's graduation last summer, and I booked well in advance, I had to pay £185 a night.
That's amazing.
And I could not believe it. I had no choice. I managed to get a room against the odds because everything was booked up, always is, during graduation week. But honestly, I don't understand how anybody can afford to stay in hotels anymore.
No, I totally agree with that. And tell you what, getting back to your great friend, Miss Liz Jones, and her column in You magazine, which I'm sure you read this week, she had a terrible experience with a hotel in London, ended up on the streets at 1 o'clock in the morning, but eventually somebody found her a room in the Zed Hotel on Fleet Street. Now, I didn't even know there was a hotel on Fleet Street, and I've never heard of the Zed Hotel. I looked it up, and they were advertising rooms at £65 a night. So I don't know what sort of a hotel that is.
Well, it doesn't sound like a very nice one, does it?
Well, they showed pictures of nice rooms and all that kind of stuff. You know, it claimed to be like, you know, a sort of a budget, what do you call little hotels?
Boutique
hotel. But I don't know where it is because I tried to find it on a map and I couldn't. But I totally agree. Staying in hotels is such a ripper. I don't know how any hotels make money anyway. Because they're not always completely full. And you know, they seem to employ so many staff and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, we've been very lucky, Miss Jones, you and I, to stay in some of the world's great hotels. So,
oh, haven't we just? Yeah. I mean, God, seeing the world on other people's money was the best gig in the world, wasn't
it? Absolutely, and we shouldn't moan. Hi, everybody. I'm going to brighten up your day by telling you about Harry's. The fantastic shaving experience. They're not just the super sharp razor company. They are much, much more. And you can start with a trial set that is absolutely free. You just have to pay for delivery. In your trial pack, you get the unique engineered and weighted Harry's handle, a 5-blade cartridge, complete with precision trimmer, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover if you're on the move. Plus, a free hydrating night spray of lotion. Absolutely everything you need for that very smooth shave. Your trial set is packaged in beautiful aquamarine containers that let you know you're in for something special. The weighted handle makes you feel you're holding something more than just a razor. And you are. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get to those hard to reach places. The foaming shave gel makes the blade skim across your face like a skater on an ice rink. And after a couple of splashes of night lotion, you'll feel your skin positively invigorated and looking healthier. Now, Harry's products are put together with 0% sulfates or dyes and are alcohol-free. Absolutely nothing to cause concern. Everything is crafted by the experts who've devised invigorating formulas, and you will feel the difference no matter what your skincare goals are. Believe me, you're a winner every time. So, folks, make sure to support our podcast, Life on Planet Porky, and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for your delivery. So here are the details. Just head to harrys.com/porky and have your trial set and free night lotion delivered to your door. I'll give you that one more time. That's harrys.com/porky.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky with myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, I tell you what, I've been looking at the serialization of a book by a guy called Matthew Engel. And it's a kind of history of modern Britain starting in the 60s. So, you know, it's not the 20th century, but sort of post-war-ish and then to the 60s. And, you know, it's fascinating for a person of my age. I don't know if you find it as fascinating when he gets to the 70s, talking about the effect of the Bay City Rollers and all that. But one fact leapt off the page and hit me. In 1962, there were only 6 Indian restaurants in the whole of this country. You know, I grew up with Indian restaurants. You know, Friday night in the Indian restaurant, you know, 10 pints of lager and all that. But I've noticed in recent years the dearth of the Indian restaurant. There isn't one now in the nearest town to me, and there used to be 2. And if you walked around London all night, would you find an Indian restaurant?
Well, I was intrigued by this, and so I looked it up.
Right.
And The Guardian actually reported that in 1960 there were 300 Indian restaurants in the UK.
Wow.
In 1980, 3,000.
Yeah.
So that in 2 decades, that had gone up tenfold,
yeah,
hadn't it? 1990, 6,600.
Wow.
And by 2011, we had 12,000 across the UK.
Yes.
And it's very interesting to think back because it wasn't a thing in our childhood, was it?
No.
Foreign food was tinned spaghetti on toast.
Oh, you bet, yeah.
We didn't even have spaghetti bolognese.
No, we didn't.
And then Vesta arrived. Do you remember Vesta?
Oh, I do. The Vesta beef curry in the packet. Oh, loved it.
So it was dried food. It was the kind of thing they take up into space, I imagine.
It was
dehydrated.
And there were nuggets of what was called beef, which when sort of boiled up, tasted like, I don't know, nothing really.
But the one I liked was the prawn curry, and then there was chow mein as well.
Yeah, I like chow.
And that's how we sort of had our first taste of foreign food, if
it's
you
true.
Like. And then the restaurants started to open.
Mm.
We didn't go out to restaurants when I was a child.
No,
we're on holiday, we would.
Yeah.
So obviously, we, you know, as a family, we'd all go out to eat when we were abroad, say Portugal or Spain or somewhere.
Yeah.
But in back home in England, we never went out to eat as a family. So I suppose it coincided, restaurants of any kind, with people's earning power ascending and having more disposable cash. And then there were opportunities because immigration began to open up, didn't
it? Yes, it did, yeah.
And these people, well, there were Chinese restaurants, come to think of it.
Oh.
There were Chinese restaurants in the West End
in
the 1700s.
Yes, that's right.
And that was to do with Chinese coming over on the ships.
Exactly.
And then jumping off the ships and settling. But this is way before Chinatown.
I mean, that's how Covent Garden started, wasn't it? You know, the Chinatown in Covent Garden from those traders who used to come here. Absolutely right. Used to come up the Thames and the trading in Chinese goods and Chinese food and all that. I don't like those Chinese restaurants in Covent Garden because I think they're all atmosphereless. They're all too bright and there's two windows are too big and all that. I prefer a nice little Chinese restaurant, you know. I think the first time I ever took a girl out for a meal was a Chinese restaurant in Chester. In fact, I'm sure it is, when I was about 17, you know what I mean? Not even old enough to drink. And I remember feeling so grown up, you know, that I was ordering food. It's been brought to the table. The table had white linen tablecloths and all that kind of stuff. So I've always thought of Chinese restaurants as quite elegant. Indian restaurants, no, not the same at all. Indian restaurants were always riotous for me. And I loved them to bits. But you can't find one anywhere these days. And so those figures you've given me sounded fantastic, but I bet you if you've got them right up to date, you'd find that a lot of them are disappearing. For instance, a couple that I used to use locally are now, you know, they serve food from a hatch at the window and all that kind of stuff, like takeaways, you know.
Okay.
Delivered by Just Eat and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah. So why are they closing down? Is it the fact that people have got less disposable income, do you think?
Well, I think there's more choice. There's a huge expansion in takeaways, isn't there? You know, you can get any food you like now by just picking up your mobile phone and ordering through Just Eat or one of these things. Because in the old days, you would ring directly, wouldn't you? Now you ring a central, you know, switchboard and they can get you any food you want anywhere you like at about 30 minutes notice. So I think people have fallen for that. In the same way that Tim Martin, my old friend, who's boss of Wetherspoons Pubs, is ringing the alarm bells about the future of the English pub, because he's, I think the figures I saw latterly were 50 a month are closing down, and Tim puts it down to the terribly unfair tax burden on pubs compared to supermarkets. When we all had to suffer lockdown, I, you know, hold my hands up and admit I'd make a trip twice a week down to Tesco's, buy a few bottles and a bottle of red wine, bring them home and drink at home. And I found it quite pleasant in the sense that, you know, sometimes the atmosphere of a pub can be, I don't know, unpleasant or overwhelming or just not very, you know, settled or something like that. I'll often have a bottle of beer at home now, which, of course, you have to buy from a supermarket. And that, again, is killing one of our great traditions, which is the English pub.
I think it's one of the last bastions of masculinity as well, isn't it? I mean, a man, you've said yourself so many times, you like to wander into a pub and sit in the corner with your papers and just have a drink by yourself and so on. A woman cannot do that because it's misconstrued.
Well, more and more
to this day.
Funny enough you say that, but I see more and more women are confident enough now to go in there. And do you know why? They can use their laptop as their companion. I've seen so many women now, they go in, they buy themselves a nice large glass of white wine, they go and sit at a table, they flip open their laptop, and that is both a safety barrier and a companion, you know what I mean?
I guess so. But younger women, do we think?
Younger women.
It's an age thing, isn't it? Because
yes.
I, frankly, don't want to go into a pub and sit there by myself, not even with a laptop.
Of course not. I totally agree with you. And I've always felt very sorry for women. I think I've said this before on this podcast. If ever I've arranged to meet one of my sisters for a drink after work, or we just happen to be in the same town at the same time or something like that, whenever I got to said pub, I always find my sister waiting outside, you know what I mean? Because they, you know, sitting at a, you know, it'd be a pub with a few tables outside, just sitting outside, not with a drink, but just not really wanting to go into the pub until I was there, you know what I mean? Because of the, as you quite rightly say, a woman feeling like she's under the microscope, you know what I mean? Or something like that.
Oh, yeah. I went to an event a few years ago now. I took Wendy Baker with me, who's married to Danny Baker, the broadcaster. Mm-hmm. And we were going to one of Mike Batt's music
Brilliant,
events.
Brilliant, yeah.
And we go into this pub around the corner. I said, let's just have a little drink before we go in. Yeah. And we go into this pub and she said, really? I said, what? Mm. She said, what, we're going to go into a pub? I said, yeah. She said, do you know, I've never been into a pub without Danny.
Golly, isn't that amazing?
She'd never been into a pub, even with another woman.
Yeah, absolutely amazing, isn't it, that there's that social barrier, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there definitely is. I mean, even the Groucho Club or Soho House, which are two private members clubs that I belong to, I wouldn't even go into either one of those unless I was meeting someone or people were joining me at some stage and order a drink over the bar, because I would feel self-conscious. Yeah. It almost looks like you're on the pull.
Well, I know exactly what you mean. Do you have any thoughts about the music of Daryl Hall?
Yeah, I love Daryl Hall.
Really?
Have you ever watched Daryl's House?
No, I haven't, no.
It's a program that he does from his own home in America.
Yeah.
And he welcomes other musicians to come in and perform. And it, you can find it on YouTube. It's a fantastic show.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I've always loved Daryl Hall as a singer. Yeah,
because I noticed that he's 76 this week, okay?
It's unbelievable.
And he's from the band Hall & Oates, okay? And got quite interested. I was reading a bit of this because I can't actually remember one of their songs. You know, it doesn't spring to mind and all that. But
what about I Can't Go For That? No Can Do.
I read that. How does that go? Can you hum it to me?
I Can't Go For That.
Oh, yeah, I know that
one. I can go for that. I'm no singer, folks.
No, but that's great. But what really intrigued me was that when I worked in America in the mid-80s, early 90s, a song you could never get away from wherever you were, whether you were in a bar and there was a jukebox, whether you were in a, Bloomingdale's, the store shopping or something like that, was Michael Jackson's Billie Jean. Billie Jean, that's my love. Da, 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 I am the one.
It's nice, a nice try.
That's right, yeah.
Billie Jean is not my woman, I think.
It's not my woman, that's right, yeah.
But it always reminded me of Billie Jean King, and I could never quite see Michael Jackson and Billie Jean King together.
It's funny you should say that. That image didn't immediately come to my mind. They made so many great videos of Michael Jackson walking on a pavement with gold paving slabs and all this kind of stuff. It was intriguing, the hold up Michael Jackson had on the music world and the American culture in the 80s was incredible. He was by far, you know, the most popular and powerful sort of pop star of all time at those times. But the point I'm making is, I read a bit about Hall & Oates, the bass line from Billie Jean was taken from a Hall & Oates song, and Michael Jackson admitted that and, you know, and praised them for it years later.
I wonder if he coughed up.
I don't know.
Usually there's a lawsuit when that kind of thing happens.
Well, I don't know how it worked out, but apparently Hall & Oates were very proud about it, you know, and Daryl Hall in particular, I think. The Michael Jackson thing is it's a bit of a problem, isn't it? Because if you admit to liking Michael Jackson's songs, and I was a fan of loads of them, it's the problem about his personal behaviour, isn't it, that was always under question.
Well, it is, because he was never convicted.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. But
so we will still hear his music on the radio.
Yeah.
And there is not the stigma against him that there is, say, against an artist like Gary Glitter.
Well, exactly. There was just so much talk about it. And, of course, since he died, people were able to make, you know, claims that were never made when he was alive and all that kind of stuff. And that's all very sad, because I really do think he was known as the King of Pop, and I think he was the King of Pop, you know, Billie Jean and all those sort of records.
Well, he was the King of Pop, and Madonna was the Queen of Pop. You know, they were untouchable in the 80s, those two.
They were, and the hold he had on the American psyche still today, you know, stays with me and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, there we go. Talking about Madonna and women as famous as her, Sarah Jane Parker, right. Seen a picture, Sarah Jane Parker, she's from Sex in the City, isn't she?
Sarah Jessica Parker,
thank you, yeah. Which I've never seen, and I think we've had this conversation before. You said to me, well, it's really a woman's programme, you know what I mean?
It's quite raunchy. There's a lot of sex in it.
Yeah, but I find it a bit uncomfortable, actually.
Especially if you're watching it with your mum.
Well,
you don't really want to see Samantha Jones being shagged up against a fire engine with no clothes on, do you?
Excuse me, Miss Jones, this is a family show.
I know, it's a family show. Well, that's what I'm saying. Okay. That is not a family show.
Yeah.
If a scene like that comes on in front of your mother,
Yes. You
tend to feel embarrassed.
Yes, well, I'd feel embarrassed if I was sitting there with my girlfriend, to be honest, or whatever. But anyway, there we go. So anyway, the point I've raised the Sarah Jessica Parker name is because I've seen a picture of her carrying around what is supposed to be the new fashion in handbags, which is a bag which is a replica of a pigeon. And it's a clutch bag, so it's almost like half a football, but it's painted like a pigeon, and it's a handbag. And I have to say, couldn't they have found a more attractive bird than a pigeon to model a handbag upon?
Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, what is the point, you know?
Yeah.
What is the bag supposed to be, really, other than a sack to carry your stuff around in?
Yeah.
Why does it need to look like a pigeon?
I don't know. I mean,
what's wrong with the common dodo?
Well, yeah, exactly. But, you know, you'd have thought a nightingale or something like that.
Or a peacock might be more appropriate. Get more room in a peacock.
Yeah, or a duck, because ducks are nice, friendly little animals, you know.
Flamingo. You sometimes see people with bags shaped like flamingos, don't
flamingos?
You?
Flamingos?
If you could have a bag shaped like any bird or animal,
Yeah. What
would be most appropriate for you?
A duck, because ducks are lovely creatures. They're very colourful, so they'd be a great colour sort of combination. But I have, as you know, I have a roof garden in my penthouse, okay, or attached to next to it. And the bane of my life are pigeons, because I have, you know, a bird bath and bird feeders and all that. And I love to see the little birds come, you know, little sort of robins, actually. There's a lot of robin redbreasts around here. But the minute the pigeons arrive, they all flee. So I don't like pigeons much. They're a damn nuisance. But to make a bag out of a... At first, I thought, oh, hang on. this woman's got a pet pigeon, because it looked so realistic. She had it under her arm, and I thought, why is she carrying a pigeon around with her? But no, it's apparently the new craze. So, Miss Joseph,
they are ugly, dirty creatures.
Yeah, I agree. But next time.
But you think back in Victorian times, Edwardian times, yeah. Women used to carry umbrellas with parrot heads, didn't they? Mary Poppins had one in the film.
Yeah, she did. You're right. Yeah.
It was a talking parrot. That's what I would like. Yeah. A talking parrot handbag.
Talking parrot handbag. Very good. Now, a few years ago in this week, Miss Jones, Ricky Hatton fought in Las Vegas and lost to a guy called Packy, somebody or other. And that's not Packy in the abusive term. It's Paqui. You know, I think he was...
Yeah, Paqui or something,
Paqui,
wasn't it?
Paqui or something like that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think he was South American. I should know his name, shouldn't I? But I went there for the fight. And your father will have done loads of fights in Las Vegas, won't he?
Oh, I used to meet my dad in Las Vegas,
right,
because I was often there doing an interview with somebody like... Harry Connick Jr. or someone who had a season at one of the great hotels in Las Vegas.
Yes.
So I quite often used to meet my dad there. Yeah,
yeah, amazing. And what an amazing city it is. So I think he was fighting at the MGM. Paqui Marino or something like that. I really should have remembered his name. And unfortunately, I think Ricky got knocked out in the second round. But it was an amazing occasion, because we were with Ricky and his dad and his fiance for all the days leading up to the fight, you know what I mean? And we'd become very close to them. So when we saw Ricky getting bashed to the ground and knocked out, you know, very forcibly, it was a terrible shock, and seeing him carried out the ring and all that kind of stuff. One of the great hotels, which I think was next door, was called Wynn's, run by Steve Wynn, a multi-millionaire guy. But the problem I had, which I found out that night, was that my engineer stroke producer, who I was at the fight with ringside, right, had developed a terrible gambling habit, right? And what you had to do after a fight like...
It's kind of why they go to Las Vegas.
Well yeah, but he hadn't gone to Las Vegas to gamble. He'd been sent there with me by TalkSport to cover the Ricky Hatton fight. And and some sponsor had paid an awful lot of money for it, you know what I mean? And we had a team there of you know, three or four of us. But this guy I needed this night. So after the fight, the whole idea is to just get to all the British fight fans, talk to them about their reaction and, you know, how shocked they were, hope Ricky's not hurt, you know, would come all the way from Manchester, because that's where he came from. And it only left.
Oh, he used to have a huge fan base, didn't he, that travelled with him? Thousands of fans across the Atlantic to support him at the ringside.
Absolutely massive. So anyway, so Ricky's carried out and all that. I thought I'd better go and speak to the fans now. And obviously in Las Vegas, they're all over the place. Except I couldn't find my engineer. And so I went and asked the rest of the team, where is he? Because he was carrying what we call the Marantz machine, which was the recording device. These days, you can actually take a microphone out and the recording equipment is in the handle of the microphone. Do you see what I mean? That's all you need. It's micro technology. Whereas in these days, probably, I don't know, 15 years ago, you had to take a machine with you to record it all. And he disappeared. Anyway, it transpired he'd become a gambling addict. And we should never have sent him to Las Vegas, because the minute he got there, all he wanted to do was get on the tables. And he'd done that night and couldn't get off the tables and disappeared. And that was the end of him.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. Yeah. So what I had to do was I had to go and get another one of these machines from one of the other guys. And then I had to carry it around and try.
You had to record yourself, basically.
I had to carry it around and try and fathom out how it worked while I was interviewing people who were mystified to see Mike Porky Parry standing there talking to the microphone in his hand and with his other hand trying to make the recording work. You know, it was dreadful, honestly.
Well, you are a jack of all trades. You know, I'm not at all surprised to hear that you managed that.
Yeah, well, I'm afraid.
He's only about 44 now, isn't he, Ricky Hatton?
He is 44, I think. Yeah, I think I think this piece said it. Yeah, it was the anniversary of this great fight.
So what's he doing now then?
He's now managing his son, who is a boxer, and I think and I think he runs a gym, you know, somewhere in the northwest of England.
Yeah.
Where of course he's very popular, you know. So
The Hitman Junior.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah, Hitman Junior. So there we are. Right. Okay, folks. Well, that's it for another week of Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for having been with us. Thank you, Miss Jones, also. And may I say to you all out there, have a great, great first week of autumn, because I believe that's what we've actually got now. And we'll see you all again this time next week. It just so happened the O2 Arena where we were doing it was the nearest hotel was the Adelphi. Now, the Adelphi was a very famous hotel between the wars. My dad used to talk about it in hushed tones, you know what I mean? Oh, we're going for lunch at the Adelphi and all that kind of stuff, you know? And it was a top posh hotel because it was the only hotel in Liverpool. Anyway.
It was like the Ritz. It was the equivalent of the Ritz in the north, wasn't it?
It was, honest to God. You know, the Adelphi Hotel, Liverpool, just at the end of Lime Street there, a couple hundred yards from Lime Street Station. And it was a landmark in the northwest of England. You're absolutely right. But when we went and stayed there a few years ago because of the O2 gig we were doing, I could not believe it. It was like a one-star hotel. And apologies to the Adelphi if it's more than one star, but that's what it seemed like to me that night.
You don't really want to see Samantha Jones being shagged up against a fire engine with no clothes on, do you?
Excuse me, Miss Jones, this is a family
I know,
show.
It's a family show. Well, that's what I'm saying, okay. That is not a family show. Yeah. If a scene like that comes on in front of your mother, you tend to feel embarrassed.
Yes, well, I'd feel embarrassed if I was sitting there with my girlfriend, to be honest, or whatever. But anyway, there we go. Couldn't they have found a more attractive bird than a pigeon to model a handbag upon?
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio-exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.